I think we're close enough to the 8 o'clock to start this morning's talk. And as usual, the first talk of a retreat is usually not the introductory talk on a Friday night, but what happens on the Saturday morning to set the scene about what we're doing here. And of course, the focus of the retreat is also always learning how to meditate. It's a word meditation, which is not a word used by the Buddha. It's an English word. The Buddha never spoke English. But what it really refers to is the ability to train the mind to make it peaceful, clear, penetrating, so it can gain understanding of so many things in our life. And of course, many people feel that meditation is all about sitting on a chair or on a cushion or on a stool. There's many things which happen before and obviously afterwards which support that meditation. Of course, the word for the meditation, the samadhi, is not concentration, as many of you have heard me say this so many times, but I have to say this, because most people read it in the old translation as concentration. And it certainly does not mean concentration, it means stillness. The concentration was a word which was put forward by Professor Rhys Davids, who was one of the first translators of those words. And he also translated Satya's mindfulness, which was brilliant. You can't do better than that. But concentration meant that many people put too much effort and control into allowing their mind to become still. And they got very tense, which meant that they would only be able to get any sense of meditation through willpower. And through the willpower, you can get so far in the path of meditation, but you come across blockages. Because you'll find out later on, if not earlier, that the key to meditation is letting go. So letting go, abandoning things, relaxing, leads to stillness. Focusing, effort, leads to concentration. And the two are very different. So, and I always justify this with all those years which I spent with a great monk like an Ajahn Chah. And he would often, not having many visual aids, he would often put up his hand and he would wave it up and down like this. And he would say, "This represents a leaf on a tree. It only moves because of the wind. If the wind stopped, the leaf would still move because of its momentum, but little by little, second by second, it would move less and less until it became perfectly still, because that was the natural state of a leaf, to be still. It would only move because something outside of it, beyond it, was making it move, the wind." And he would continue, he said, "That's the same as the human mind. The nature of the human mind is to be still. It only moves because something outside of it is making it move. Basically, you're wanting, desires and craving." So understanding that overarching metaphor that our job is to sit here and see if we can do nothing, which is the most difficult thing to do. Not to focus the mind, but to leave the mind alone. And let it come to what we call its default state. And of course, many people also complain, "If I leave things alone, I'll just go to sleep. Or my mind will wander all over the place." No, that is not the truth of things. If you practice long enough of developing stillness in the mind, stillness generates energy. And this is one of the important parts of meditation. It's one of the joyful parts of meditation. It's what makes it really fun. that when you are still, your mind is not wasting and using any energy at all. Even when you're thinking, worrying, planning, complaining, or trying to remember, you use so much mental energy. I think it's something like 20 or 30% of your energy intake is used in your brain, which compared to its size and its mass is a disproportionate amount of energy which you use. Where does it all go? Thinking and planning. So I often contemplate, what would happen if that you didn't think very much at all? Your mind was still and it didn't use so much energy. And of course, the answer is, well, that energy has got to go somewhere. It's not being used by the brain. So it usually goes into building up a reserve of fat in your tummy. That is one of the reasons why I'm fat. It's because I don't think enough. It's all right to laugh. It encourages me. But there is some truth to that. That's not total joke. Because you notice people who worry and are extremely concerned, they do lose weight. And the reason is because thinking takes up a lot of energy. But it's not just to lose weight or put on weight. What happens when the mind becomes still? The energy builds up, and most of that energy goes into mindfulness, awareness. You become more and more aware. To know what I mean, that sometimes if you get up in the morning and it's dark, you don't know where you are, you may just knock things over in your room, and just drop stuff, hit things, because you are not fully awake yet. And if you turn on the lights, have a cup of tea or coffee or whatever you have, and you really start sort of getting some energy up inside of you, then you can be aware. Now imagine just extrapolating, going further, so you're not just that aware, you become super aware. And that's one of the parts of this meditation which is not taught enough, and which is one of the great joys of a meditation based on stillness. Just keeping it here and allowing the meditation, the energy of meditation, to build up until you get more and more and more aware. It's hard to find similes for these phenomena, but a simile which any men here will probably appreciate, that sometimes when I go travelling, they put me up in a nice hotel for the night, and in the morning when I shave, I have to shave every morning, sometimes say, why do you have to shave every morning? Because it's acceptable practice here. There's one of the monks who I won't name, but he's now in Albany. So you know who he is. He's a forest monk, and so just, you know, he's shaving every 3 or 4 days. And the Thai people complained to me about him. So you tell him to, you know, just, no, he's a monk, senior monk now. He's got a sort of look, sort of well-shaven. So I had to tell him, I said, do I have to? I said, yes, come on. So, but when I go in these hotels, I have to shave in the morning. Sometimes, if it's in the monastery, I usually shave in the morning time, and it's not that light. You haven't got these incredible mirrors, and they're just an old mirror, so I can just shave pretty quickly. But in some of these hotels, they have these big mirrors which are magnified, they've got lights on. And oh, it takes forever because I can see a little bit of stubble here, a little bit of stubble there. If I can't see it, I don't notice it. So it's much easier. That is a nice simile for meditation and powerful mindfulness. If you're not that mindfulness, you can't see many defilements. They're there, but you can't notice them. But when the lights are really on, then you can really see what's going on. So this is what happens with the mindfulness. It gets stronger and stronger. That's part of the effect of stillness. And because the mind gets stronger and stronger. You can also see some of the more hindrances, the sorts of things which you do, the attitudes, the wrong responses, which again take away the stillness. The stillness, the mindfulness, they work together with energy. Those three things get stronger and stronger. The more still, the more aware, the more awake you are, and the more energy you have. And that energy starts to see things in beautiful ways. So, first story. Okay, I'm going to, when this first occurred in my life as a meditation practitioner, still a student, I could say I was 19 years of age at the time, so that I'll put it in 1970, 71, somewhere around that time. Our meditation group decided to have a retreat. No retreat centers, just using boarding houses during the vacation time. And quite a strict retreat, most of the meditation was done in our rooms instead of like together. Just, you know, you got a nice little room there, go in there and meditate. And I allowed out 1 hour every morning to have a walk, have some exercise. The rest of the time it was meditating, listening to talks or having interviews for 8-9 days. And I remember really clearly that every morning, because, you know, it was in Cambridge and I got to know that place very well, I chose to go for a walk at the Botanical Gardens. They had a back entrance, just very close to where the boarding houses were. I knew it very well, so I could just go in there, and I thought, early in the morning, a nice walk in the Cambridge Botanical Gardens. You can't get better than that. But I never got past the entrance. The entrance was open, but when I turned around into the Botanical Gardens, there was this most exquisite clump of bamboo. And it was gorgeous, and it captivated my attention so much that I just could not carry on walking. I was just gazing at it, as if, you know, how can such a beautiful plant exist in a climate like England? And even worse, you know, on the plains at Cambridge, it was flat area, so the winds would be very chilling in the wintertime. But it was absolutely fascinating. You understand sometimes why painters, especially Chinese watercolors, always include bamboo. And even just in gardens, always like to see bamboo because it's a very simple plant, but it's very nature, just, you know, like a big grass basically. So small, so stout at the bottom, and it just tapers just so gently. Even you may call sensuously, as it also bends under its own weight into this beautiful arc. And the colours are not bright and gaudy, they're like roses and other flowers. It's a very delicate and a subdued but very beautiful interaction of colour and just the shape bending, slender shape bending in under its own weight. And sometimes in the morning when the wind is blowing, you can see it sway, almost like dancing in the early morning wind. And so I looked at that and I was so amazed at its beauty. And as a young man, I just stared. But I do remember having some presence of mind to realize in those were days when young people of my age were taking drugs. I never took those drugs. And they were taking drugs. And so I thought that if somebody saw this young man, I had everything else about that age, my green velvet trousers, my long hair and long beard, you would not have recognized me. If I could somehow do a magic feat and bring out the young student, sit him next to me, to think that that turned into this was just beyond credibility. But nevertheless, I was standing there and realized But if somebody saw me just standing staring, open-mouthed, at a clump of bamboo, they would have called the doctors and I would have been committed into the local institution for people with emotional problems. It was not done in a place like UK. So at least I had the presence of mind to just sit down on a bench. That was acceptable. It's amazing just how some behaviour doesn't threaten people and is acceptable. Other behaviour does. So I just was writing to a friend yesterday that when I was in UK recently, this is totally off subject, going on a tangent, which I love doing, that when I was visiting my family in England just a couple of weeks ago, and going from my family's residence to a talk in London, going on the underground, on the tube trains. And I like going on the tube trains. It's also following my teacher's instructions. Ajahn Chah said, if you go overseas, don't just stay in your temple so people never see you. Get out and walk or use public transport as much as you possibly can. So actually people see, there's monks around, there's nuns around. It's important that people see you. Not just in the temple where they already know you are, but you know, just other places. So I was sitting down, minding my own business, and of course, you know, that sometimes it's very rare to see someone dressed like this in an underground carriage, but then after a few minutes, I noticed all these zombies coming into the railway carriage. And then a few vampires. And then some witches. It was Halloween's night. October the 31st. And for once, because the carriage started filling up with all these people dressed to go to Halloween parties. And for once in my life, going on an underground train, I felt I did not stand out. A few other people came in suits and dresses. They stood out. They were the weirdos. But not me. But unfortunately, I must have not been scary enough because I didn't get anything to, no sweets or candies or anything. Not that I needed anymore. But anyway, sometimes it's strange just how people look at the world and what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. Sometimes there's no logic behind it. But anyway, there I was just sitting down, staring at this clump of bamboo. And I never finished with it and had to drag myself away to actually to go, not for the morning talk, but for breakfast. A young man, it was important to me. But I said, I'll be back the next day. For 8 days, I went back to that same clump of bamboo, stared at it, never finished with it. It was beautiful. And that was maybe 50 minutes every day for 8 minutes, 400 minutes. That's a lot of hours staring at this little clump of bamboo. And it was just so gorgeous, so beautiful, I didn't want to go anywhere else. So, a few days later, retreat over. Nice free afternoon. And what did I do? I thought, I'm going to go and visit my most beautiful clump of bamboo in the world. And so I was studying now, you know, back to lectures and tutorials and stuff, on my bicycling through the Cambridge traffic, got to the entrance to the Cambridge Botanical Gardens. I was all wound up to see my most beautiful clump of bamboo and to spend an hour just enjoying it. And what did I see? This dry, desiccated clump of useless bamboo with hardly any leaves on it. It was just dusty, dirty, and because bamboo doesn't really belong in that climate. And what shocked me was, where was the beauty gone? Where was the delight? I could see so much in that for 8 days, no exaggeration, never finished with enjoying its beauty. What had happened? Obviously, my mind had now gone back to normal, stressed out, tired, worrying about parties and grades and thinking and socializing with my mates, trying to avoid getting hit in the traffic. So it was a lot of stress. My mind had closed up and couldn't see beauty anymore. And that was one of the first times I realized on a meditation retreat, if you follow the instructions and do really relax and get some stillness in your mind just wakes up. It energizes. It's not just you can see sort of detail in a dusty, desiccated clump of bamboo. You can see beauty everywhere. You're energized. You are beginning to know the secret of happiness. Happiness and beauty is not out there. It's a sign of the power of your mind. How energized you are. And now, quote I usually say at this point, from William Blake, to see your world, a 17th century poet and artist as well, to see your world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, an eternity in an hour. At this point I do make the connection, the talks are usually 1 hour, but please don't look upon it as eternity. The eternity just meant just the shortest time, which rhymed with flower. So, but what that meant, see a world in a grain of sand, something insignificant, even boring, to allow that to sort of open up and to see so much in it, that is the sign of your mindfulness is seeing way beyond what you've been trained to see and what other people see. You really are seeing deeply into something and seeing details, seeing features which are hidden to you when you're going too fast or when the mind is tired. And see a heaven and a wild flower. Now, fortunately, that West Australia, there's many, many wild flowers and people come from overseas to see the wild flowers. People like me avoid the wild flowers because it makes me sneeze with hay fever, which is one of the reasons why all the flowers here, they're beautiful flowers, because they are plastic or paper or something, to the point that even sometimes that when I teach retreats, oh, where was this last one? Even in town, in Nolabara Center, the people were just, they said, well, we don't want to torture you, because as a monk you have to sit closest to the shrine. What flowers are you not allergic to? And being me, I said, well, the only flower I'm certain I'm not allergic to is cauliflower. So on the shrine in front of the Buddha, they put cauliflowers. And they did that recently somewhere, I forget where I was. It must have been in Malaysia or somewhere. But so you see a world see a heaven in a wild flower. Because you all know the wild flowers are tiny things. Sometimes they just hide amidst the grasses. And when you see them, they're tiny, they're almost like humble, shy. And then you just look at them and they're absolutely amazing. But you have to stay with them to allow them to show you how beautiful they are. To allow the mind to rest and it opens up to you. And that's an important part of meditation. To empower your mindfulness. Because you're going to spend a long time in the next 8-9 days just watching your breath. Breathing in, breathing out. How many times I want to watch this boring breath. Breathing in again, I've done this so many times. Breathing out, oh yeah. You'll get bored and you will fall asleep. Or you'll start rummaging through your list of fantasies and plans, useless plans which have no purpose at all, or just memories, both good and bad, anything, just to take away the boredom of watching your breath. Just like I recall when I was a school teacher for 1 year, only for 1 year, that made me just give up any desire to have a family. Looking after teenagers, oh. Now, they were actually quite cute and quite good. But when I used to come home after teaching, I used to be so exhausted that you just make a cup of tea, any cup of tea would do as soon as you possibly could, turn on the TV. This is when I was a teacher, before I became a monk. And anything, watch the most stupid kids' programs. Oh, this is, just brings back memories. I don't know if any of you remember Basil Brush. Remember that fellow? No, you don't know, because it's an old time. And probably anyone with any sort of maturity wouldn't watch such juvenile nonsense. But I did. Simply because I was exhausted on anything. And that's what happens when you meditate and you're tired. Anything will do. So what happens when the mindfulness starts to get strong? And you see, you know, you see even this body. It's amazing just what goes on in this body. It's just time to relax it, get to know it, really get to know it. Even at my age, 68, and just falling apart, but then you can start to see it's actually quite beautiful in here. See how everything works and how it works together. And once it gets really relaxed, not actually really relaxed, but reasonably relaxed, I always notice just how delightful my body feels. It's just, when you get up in the morning, or you don't, no, before you get up in the morning, you're lying in your bed, and it's nice and cozy, and it's relaxed. You haven't got backache, you haven't got knee ache, you haven't got nose ache. That's what I have, because hay fever. I always wanted to know that in medical science, you can have transplants for your kidneys, for your heart, for your liver, for your cornea. When are we going to have a nose transplant? So then I wouldn't have any problem with hay fever or itchy noses. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could have nose transplants? And then, once we can have nose transplants, you know, you have the choice. What type of nose do you want? And I thought that, you know, because it's really important for people of our modern age to put multiculturalism to the fore, I mean really to the fore. And because, you know, I travel to places like Sri Lanka a lot, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a brown Sri Lankan nose in front of my face? So it was brown in the front and then white on the outside. Would that be a good idea?
No.
Why? Okay, a Chinese nose. Get one from Malaysia or Singapore or Hong Kong somewhere and put that in my face.
From Korea.
For a Korean nose. I know, actually, those Korean noses, they just mess them around, don't they, in Gangnam. They have facial surgery, I don't know. But anyway, I don't know why. But anyway, you can understand what happens, that when you start to really relax the body, it actually feels delightful. And I sometimes wondered, even at that stage, why? Wake up in the morning, nice and relaxed, why does it feel delightful? Number one, because you've woken up, you know, your mind is fresh, and because you're looking at your body, there's no aches, no pains. Everything becomes really quite pleasant. It's one of the reasons why people go to beaches and just they lay on these recliners, physically comfortable, delighted with just having a relaxed body. But the strange thing was, when I started to look at this in meditation practice, just sitting here at the beginning of my meditation, just looking at the whole body, relaxed bit by bit, the whole lot appeared delightful. In other words, there was a pleasure of a body which wasn't under stress. And as soon as I became aware of that delight, the relaxation got deeper. And it taught me something, another little interesting insight into the path of meditation. The path of delight allows you to let go more. A path of struggle creates more tension, more clinging on, and you don't go as far, not as happy. So when my body was really relaxed, it's delightful. Now I'm going to relax my mind. In exactly the same way, why is your body just tense? You're putting it somewhere. It's being extended. It's being squashed. It's not being like loose and easy. And for my mind, it's just, I want something. Or I don't want something. Or I'm afraid of something. I'm anxious. I'm just worried about, you know, what I should be doing back in the monastery. Or I'm worried about what happened in the past. Those all pull you and push you. Tightness is on you. Stretching you this way, putting you that way, squashing you. So you're never really relaxed and peaceful. And what do people do in meditation retreats? They get to their mind and they hammer the hell out of it. Come on, watch the breath. How many times do I have to tell you? You've only got 8 days, 9 days, watch your breath. Not watching the breath? Slap. That does not work at all. You can meditate, you can stay still, but it's out of fear. It's out of control. There's no happiness can come there. No joy. But when you really relax, then at first, you will wander off, you may sort of doze off and have some other ideas, but just persist until you get to a point where your mind is so relaxed that it is also pleasant. The delightful present moment awareness. Just being here, just enjoying this moment. Just like the body, free of stress. No one telling you what to do or how to do it. Nowhere to go. Nothing to attain. Just being here, perfectly at ease. When you don't want to be anywhere else in the whole world, except right here with an itchy nose. It's not a bad deal. Many worse things I could have in my body. And there's not an itchy nose. Or a cough. Wonderful thing, just have a cough. That's all you have. There's other people who are really in aches and pains. But all you've got is a cough. Wonderful, thank you, cough. That's good enough for me. Little by little, one opens the door of the heart to this moment. Allows it to be. And your mind gets very content. And easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature. For those who got up early this morning, we chanted that. By the end of this retreat, you will have had that brainwashed into you by all this chanting. So that means that the mind is content, easily satisfied, and it relaxes. And little by little, the mind wakes up, it energizes. Because you're not trying to get anywhere, and that's one of Ajahn Chah's other sayings. I just know sometimes how dumb can a monk like me be. So many times he said, you meditate to let go, not to attain something. So, okay, let go. I let go so I could try and attain something. But that was totally wrong. It's not working, Ajahn Chah. I've followed your instructions, I've let him go, but I haven't attained anything. Didn't I tell you, don't try to attain something? Letting go is not a skillful means, like a trick, you know, like an ambit claim to actually to try and get something. It has to be full on. Letting go, not trying to attain anything at all, just being here. No wanting, not even for good things, let alone wanting to get rid of bad things. Just no wanting at all, just being here. At first you do get sleepy. At first you do get, maybe have an old thought come up in the mind. But persist, just wanting to be here. And then after a while, the mind energizes. the mindfulness becomes powerful enough to see what you're up to, what your mind is doing, and to see how we can, don't need to be sleepy anymore. When that clump of bamboo looks beautiful, you can't sort of fall asleep with it. The beauty is what energizes you. In Thailand, first year, we had to do these all-night meditations once a week. And it came to about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was really tired. And then I started contemplating, why am I tired? At one, just because it says 1 a.m. in the morning, is that reason to be tired? Because I would count back maybe 12 months or 2 years, and I'd go to all these all-night parties or all-night rock concerts. For anybody who knows that sort of scene, I remember just going to this all-night rock concert at Jefferson Airplane, 2 hours, then the Doors, 2 hours, then Jefferson Airplane, another 2 hours, then the Doors, 2 hours. Anyone who likes rock music, wow, you went there, they get so jealous. But you know, when I was going to rock concerts at 1 o'clock in the morning, I wasn't tired at all. I never had sloth and torpor. Because I was excited and enjoying every moment of what was going on. You ask, some of your husbands, they're watching the cricket match from Sri Lanka, and it's 1 o'clock in the morning. Are they tired? No, they're just waiting for the next ball to come down. So it just really is a matter of how much energy you have and how much delight you have in what you're doing. That is the only reason why people get tired. So what happens is, after a while, the energy starts to build up and you become aware of what's happening, and it's joyful, it's delightful. People say, well, how can it be delightful to watch the breath? That's one of the most boring things in the whole world to watch. Can't you just like scan your body or just do a visualization of the Buddha or do something which is a bit more pizzazz instead of the breath? But of course, that's not what happens. You just watch one breath and see a heaven and a wildflower. See just thousands of different movements which will never be repeated. Every breath you'll ever take from the beginning of your life to your last breath will be totally unique. No two breaths are ever the same. And you can see so much in the breath. You can see that. It becomes delightful. Once it's delightful, the mind goes into it, and it opens up, and you can see so much there. A whole world in a grain of sand. Just a whole life in just one in-breath, from the beginning to the end. That's what happens. Now, this is not another thing to attain. You come into Semi Ajahn Bam, yeah, I attained to the stage of seeing 1,000 different things in one breath. Now what? These are not stages. Tick off stage one. Yes, I've done that. Now stage two. Ajahn Bam, I'm on stage three. How can I get to stage four? There's nothing like that. Please don't have. It's not like school, with O levels, A levels, degrees. Bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, PhD's degrees, post-PhD, even post-post-PhD, just never ends. Instead, this is a natural unfolding of the mind when it gets powerful. And of course, when it does get powerful, that's an easy thing for you to notice. It's natural, and you start to wake up, you're energized, and also you are happy. It's not just seeing a world in a grain of sand, it's seeing a heaven in a wildflower. The breath looks delightful, from the very beginning to the end. And it's not just your breath. When you go do your walking meditation, you look in front of you, you see your body length in front of you, not to the left, not to the right, just in front of you, on the ground, just to make sure you're not stepping on something or you're not going to hit the wall. And you just, hands wherever you want to put them, you can put them in front of you, You can put them just by your side. You can put them on your head if you want. You can walk like a toy soldier if you want. I don't care, but whatever you do, just decide and just have done with it. And you're watching there, and you're putting most of the awareness on the movement of your feet. Just to be able to lift a foot off the ground. How many different muscles have to move just so you can lift? For me, like the heel comes off first of all. And I notice what part of my foot comes off the ground first of all as I move up. And just the way that my foot moves up through the air. Is it vertical? Or does it come back a bit? Does it go forward a bit? To the side a bit? You really get aware of something as simple as just the lifting of your right foot, beginning that first step, and how it goes forward, and then goes down on the ground, and the flat on the floor, and the weight goes from one leg to the other leg. All those amazing parts of just one step. And once you start to have enough awareness to be able to see this, it's not forced at all. It's actually just quite delightful, enjoyable. And you really get put into this just walking. Never realize just how many things have to happen just for one step to occur. And you're just watching all of it. And it's fascinating. Not just fascinating, but it gets delightful as well. And so sometimes when you're doing your walking meditation, just lifting it up, you don't need to give it names, because sometimes even giving it names, lifting, going forward, putting down, whatever it is, some of the names are just not enough. They're just too much approximations, which doesn't really just capture just all the feelings and the movement of just lifting up. It's much more than that. So you just don't give it a name, but feel it, know it. And as you're just doing the walking meditation, after a while that becomes really delightful. Some people prefer the walking meditation because you don't have bum ache, knee ache, back ache, or any other aches because you're moving. So that's one of the reasons why some people love the walking meditation. And once you're doing the walking meditation, it starts to get delightful. Oh, you're having a wonderful time, because it's so delightful just watching all these movements of the feet as they go forward. You can do that for hours. Very happy. And the experience, which, again, I mentioned already, the most beautiful clump of bamboo story. Once, this was in the meditation hall in Thailand, because it was the monsoon season and it was just not feasible to walk outside, otherwise it wouldn't be walking meditation, it would be swimming meditation. The place would flood. So inside the hall we'd be doing the walking meditation. And this hall was built just not by professional builders, it was built by the villagers. So when they did the concrete, it was all lumpy. And whenever they needed to put a bit of water on to try and smooth it, they wouldn't use water, they'd spit on it. And to try and smooth it out. So it was just all different colours and bumpy. But I remember just doing the walking meditation, just lifting up and just think, amazing, just how many sensations. And you're looking at the floor, and then I stopped. I couldn't walk because the floor, the grey concrete, it was amazing what you could see in there. It was just like before, all the contours of it. You know, because some was high, some was low, it's like you see valleys and peaks in just a simple piece of concrete. And I know that sometimes I said this some time ago, and I said, Ajahn Brahm, be careful of saying this. Because, you know, it was just, I saw all these different shades of grey. And apparently that was a naughty book which was published some years ago after I had this experience. But you can see so many different shades of the grey, the dark and the lighter type of greys, just all melded together in this lump of concrete. which I was looking at. And again, the reason was because your mind was so alert that even in an ordinary, boring piece of concrete, you could see so much beauty. And I just stood there for about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, going, wow, wow, wow. Amazing what was happening there. Your mindfulness was really sort of getting very strong and see the beauty. Now, later on, when I will teach more about the breath meditation, you may have already seen this yourself if you've seen how the Buddha described Anapanasati. That the breath, once you can be aware of the breath, you start to be aware of the piti and the sukha, which are with the breath. That means the joy and happiness. And sometimes that people just pass that, not realizing its enormous significance. That is a sign that you're watching the breath with that degree of mindfulness, that if you can see just the beauty in a lump of bamboo or a piece of concrete, oh, you can see amazing beauty in the breath. Right from the beginning to the end. Oh. You're actually experiencing the piti, sukha, the joy and happiness along with the breathing. And often I've called that, a time and time again, the pivot point of meditation. And if I have any goals at all, is actually to get everybody to that one point where, whether it's walking meditation or breath meditation, the breath starts to become so delightful. And you're not making this up, it just sometimes comes as a surprise. Just sitting here, just as happy as can be, just watching a breath come in and watching the breath go out, or just walking really comfortably, just blissing out. And sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, this is religion. You're not supposed to be happy until you die. That's what we know. So we sacrifice everything now. We do sort of terrible, torturous practices. We give all our money into the donation box. We work like a slave for the temple, hopefully so that when we die, then we can be happy. Did you ever buy into that? I never did at all, because, yeah, okay, just going praying and doing torturous practices and so that when you die, somehow or other that gets into your credit book so that you can be happy after you die. Where's the proof? Where's the money back guarantee? What if you back the wrong religion, go to the wrong teacher? So I wanted that happiness, some proof of it now, so I can be sure that you're going on the right path. And so just to be able to meditate and get all this bliss and happiness coming up, wow, that was nice. And sometimes people ask you, how did you cope in Thailand? The food was disgusting. Frog soup. Frog soup meant these tiny frogs about this big in a saucepan of boiling water with no sauce, no chili, no salt, no garlic, just boiled frog, as if they just jumped out there into the pot themselves, and sticky rice. And that was your one meal of the day, nothing else. You can eat as many frogs as you wished. For those of you who ever watched Monty Python, precursor to Monty Python was at last the 1948 show, and before that there was a radio show, I'm sorry I'll read that again, Bill Oddie and John Cleese. This is where they started off, and I recall it was just a cult. I used to follow that with my mates from university. And the one of the sketches, though, it's a radio sketch, was about the old movie theatres. You know, movie theatres, they sell popcorn or they sell ice cream. And this movie theatre, they came in, crunchy frog, buy your crunchy frog. and says, oh, I'll have a crunchy frog. And then he eats the crunchy frog and said, oh, you haven't even taken the bones out. He said, of course, that's what makes it crunchy. He laughed and it was wonderful. And I laughed and I thought that was so gross, you know, the gross humour of that sort of type of comedy. And then a couple of years later, I was actually eating crunchy frog. You put it in your mouth and go, crunch it. Whole frogs. So it's gross food, a climate you're being eaten by mosquitoes all the time. No mosquito repellent, no mosquito nets. Getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Not actually, what time are you supposed to get up here? 4 or 5?
4 o'clock.
Well, that's just so lax, so lazy. That's okay. At 3 o'clock in the morning, in the jungles, just a language you didn't understand, climate which was so hot and sticky. Oh, and just sometimes you wonder, how could you do that? I think you know the answer. There's so much joy and happiness in your meditation. It made even the crunchy frog delicious.
They are delicious.
They are delicious. Weird. Maybe they're fried, deep fried or something, but, you know, when they're sort of just boiled. But anyway, because your mind was just so mindfulness was getting so strong, everything looked beautiful. Even a piece of bamboo and the concrete looks beautiful. Everything looks beautiful. This is one of the parts of meditation. It's a sign of mindfulness getting strong. That everything is empowered. So even the food. Oh, the food here is delicious anyway. I have to say that because the cook's sitting in the back over there. But it is delicious. But it's even more delicious after a good meditation. Some of the, okay. Not this year, the year before. I always have a 15-day private retreat, go in my cave and I don't talk to anybody, except the person who brings the food. And after my 2-week retreat was over, down into the dining hall at Bodhidharma and for breakfast. And that morning, it was baked beans. I just took one baked bean, not on a spoon, just one, a single one, put it in my mouth. Wow. That was almost orgasmic. Just, have you ever really sort of appreciated just one single baked bean? Really mindful, slow, and just the tangy tomato sauce with a tiny bit of salt, just perfectly balanced, as you allow that to sink into your taste buds. And then my teeth just crushed the very soft bean. It's got a texture, it's not hard, it's not just a melt, it's somewhere in between, it's its own little texture. And I thought that was amazing. And I was thinking, wow, this baked bean, who made this baked bean? Did Jamie Oliver visit the monastery while I was on a retreat? And they said, no, it's only from a can. But that's what it tasted like. And there's no exaggeration, I remember that. Wow! I've never tasted a baked bean like that ever before. Of course, I tasted many baked beans, but just with nice samadhi, deep meditation, you get very happy. So then when you start watching the breath, ooh, then you're off. Just watch the breath go in, wow, this is beautiful. Go out, and just the beauty gets so strong, so wonderful. The beauty is, it's a citta sankhara. For those of you who want to know the essence of these things, as the Buddha taught it, the citta sankhara is what the mind adds on to the baked bean or the breath or the piece of concrete, and it gets so beautiful with the breath, and then it gets, you really start to bliss out. And that bliss turns into this beautiful, you're energizing your mind, pouring energy into it, until when the mind gets so strong, you can't see the breath anymore. It's these beautiful lights in the mind, the limitless. Once you start getting out of it, again, then you're really sort of having a wonderful time. Beautiful lights in the mind called limitless. And they get stronger and stronger. You empower your mind immensely.
So afterwards, you maybe get into a jhana or something. One of the things you can do, which is really fun to do, and you do this, you get into a nimitta stage or just afterwards, then just before, you know, when you start to see it sort of, you know, it's been there a while, you ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? Because if your mind gets to those nimittas, it's like what we call five hindrances. Those defilements of the mind are just so weakened that you can start to see things from the past. Your mind can recall what it was like to be born. What was it like before you were born? Your previous lives. That is interesting stuff. It doesn't matter whether you believe in it or not, it's there. And the nice thing about these memories when you get them through meditation is that there's no doubt that that was you. No more there's any doubt that, you know, that your room where you slept last night, that was actually your room, you actually slept there. Very clear. Which is, you don't get that through the such degree of clarity through the hypnotic regressions, but you do through meditation. And sometimes, stupid Ajahn Brahm, why? It's obvious because five hindrances aren't there in the deep meditation. The fifth hindrance, doubt, has been eradicated. So of course, what you experience in that state, oh, obviously that's you. So anyway, interesting stuff which you can do simply when you start following the instructions and stop trying to concentrate, but instead learn to be still. Simple. It only moves because you want something. Stop wanting. Be content, easily satisfied. Not proud, not demanding anything at all. That's stillness. And everything else just follows afterwards. Was that a good marketing message? I think so, because I can read your mind. Oh yeah, I want to do this, come on. So okay, have a wonderful morning. And if it doesn't work, you can always have lunch to look forward to. And then see what happens in the afternoon. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.